Today's episode contains testimony about suicidal ideation. Listener discretion is advised.
This case is unique with respect to not having a body, but not unusual. And you heard that from Special Agent Yurgis. You were told that he himself is working on three of those in Wisconsin. This is actually something that is maybe a newer phenomenon to some, but some of us that do this work, it's simply not. Because nobody should get away with murder because they have hidden a body somewhere.
In April 2013, 59-year-old Vicky Prokopovitz disappeared from her home in Pittsfield, Wisconsin. She lived there with her husband, Jim, and her adult son, Wesley. All of her belongings were left behind. With no sign of Vicky for over 5 years, the investigation went from a missing persons case to a murder investigation. The district attorney of Brown County, Wisconsin, Wendy Lemkuhl, decided to move forward with the case despite not locating Vicky's remains. They had their suspect, and they were sure he was responsible for Vicky's disappearance. But with no body having been recovered, and with a defense who would use Vicky's own words against her, the prosecution seemingly faced an uphill battle.
Next time, no one will find me. That was a statement that Victoria Prokopovitz stated to her family the second time she tried to commit suicide. I'm going to say it again. Next time, no one will find me.
The jury heard about Vicky's struggle with mental health, a struggle that began at just 18 years old. Her three children told the court of seeing their mom's battle firsthand. Her daughter, Marcia, recounted an incident from 1987 when she was 15.
Was there an incident where you came upon your mom in what was perceived as an attempt, a suicide attempt, in a vehicle?
Yes.
How did that occur?
I don't remember the details about how it happened or why it happened. I know that she wanted the suffering to end. She was in a car in the garage with the garage door shut. The car was running, and my sister and I walked in and begged her to come back in.
Vicky's son, Wesley, told the jury about another incident in 2003.
In 2002-2003, was there an incident where you came home and you found your mom?
Yes.
What happened with respect to that?
I was not living at home at the time. I was living on my own. And where I was working at the time, on my way home, I was driving, caused me to drive past her house. And I thought I'd just stop by and say hi, being I was driving by. And when I walked in the door, I seen the pills all over the floor, and I seen her laying on the floor, and that's how I found her.
Her family knew of her earlier attempts to die by suicide, but the prosecution delved deeper into Vicky's treatment and state of mind at the time she disappeared. According to her doctor at the time, she seemed to be doing exceptionally well. The defense, however, was much more interested in a diagnosis from roughly 20 years prior.
Dr. Coffey, according to your note, diagnosed her suffering from multiple personality disorders. Is that right?
That's right.
You even noted that one of her personality's names was Lucy.
That's right.
What happened to Vicky Prokopovitz? Did she walk away from everything she knew? Did she die by suicide? Or was she murdered?
We didn't know where my mom was, so that was confusing. And the only thing I knew is in the pit of my stomach is I thought, something's not right.
I found where they had their first phone conversation, I think May 19th, and several phone conversations after that. I mean, all hours of the day, night.
8 years after her disappearance, prosecutors would finally bring their case to a jury, would they find that Jim Prokopovitz killed his wife? This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 155. 59-year-old mother and grandmother, Victoria Vicky Prokopovitz, didn't have an easy life. Her struggles with mental illness were documented at the age of 18. She married a man named Daryl Edges and had four children, one who died when they were a baby. According to their daughter, Marsha, her father was physically abusive to her mom. It was a fact Vicky tried to keep hidden and would often make up excuses for her injuries.
At that time and through the years as you were growing up, did you see whether or not your mother was telling people about that?
Not always. Just her close circle knew. She had excuses for her bruises.
That's what I was going to say, though. Was she indicating to others that they had been caused at the hands of your father, or was she making excuses about how she received them?
Making excuses.
By 1985, Vicky had gotten out of the marriage. While playing with a CB radio at home, she met someone new. Jim Prokopovitz was a truck driver. The two began their relationship over the airwaves.
And then when you moved in, you were discussed that you were part of a blended family, correct?
Yes.
When you moved in, did Jim accept you and your sister and your brother pretty quickly?
Yes.
Treated you like his own kids?
Yes.
And in fact, your mom treated Lisa and Wally, James Jr., as her own kids.
Yes, they were very much a family.
Within months, they moved in together. They created a yours, mine, and ours atmosphere in Jim's home, with Vicky's three children and Jim's two children. It was in that home where Marsha and her sister Stacy first saw their mother at one of her worst moments. According to Marsha, the girls found their mother in the garage, trying to end her life. Vicky sought treatment and things seemed to be looking up. She and Jim got married in October 1989. The bond between Vicky's children and Jim had grown strong. Even with their biological father still alive, they referred to Jim as Dad. He even walked Marsha down the aisle when she got married. Before that wedding in 1992, Vicky got a new diagnosis from her doctor.
And with respect to your mother's mental health, as we indicated, that is something that was known.
Yes.
But was that something that was very personal and private to her?
Yes.
Is it difficult for you to hear something like that be exploited in any way when that multi-personality disorder was back over? I guess it would have been more than 25 years ago.
Yeah.
With respect to depression, though, that was something that was in her world at times.
Yes.
Okay. And just like anything, sometimes she was attempting to address it and she was living with that.
Yes.
And in turn, all of you had to live with that.
Yes.
Moving to your mom's mental health a little bit, you testified that your mom had mental health issues. Is that as far as you remember back, she always had mental health issues?
She always had some sort of depression or anxiety.
Okay. The state asked you, or District Lemkohl brought up the fact about the multiple personality issues, and you indicated that it was when you were younger she had these multiple personalities, correct?
It was before I got married.
So was it in your teenage years?
Yes.
Okay. So would she be with Jim during that time she had these multiple personalities?
Yes.
That was a yes?
Yes.
Okay. Do you recall any of the names of these personalities?
I don't off the top of my head. I only witnessed one or two episodes of it. Okay. I was not living in the home.
Do you know how many personalities she was diagnosed with?
I'm going to object to the relevancy of this. It's remote in nature, Your Honor. There's nothing that's been indicated that it's relevant to this incident in April of 2013.
No, I disagree. I mean, we've been talking about this, the mental illness the whole time. So I'm going to let this cross-examination.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Now, Ms. Lawrence, do you know approximately how many personalities she had?
No.
Okay. Do you know if she was ever determined by doctors that she was cured of these multiple personalities?
Standing objection to relevancy, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I think it's very relevant.
Yeah, I think it is, too. You're overruled and your objection's noted. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, do you know if she was ever been told by doctors that she was cured of these multiple personalities?
I don't. I didn't go with her to her appointments.
The multiple personality disorder was a main focus during Jim's trial. Their daughter, Marcia, told the court she didn't know if her mom was cured at the time of her disappearance. Vicky was close to all of her children as they grew up, but in 1992, she became even closer with her son, Wesley, after a life-changing accident. He was working on his dirt bike with his friend and was burned. According to his testimony, Wesley had burns on 70% of his body. He was sent to a burn center in Milwaukee. Vicky only left his side once.
He was mixing some two-cycle oil for his dirt bike, and his friend pushed it over on him, and he was lit on fire and burned from his shoulders to his knees.
Okay.
And spent 6 months in the Milwaukee Burn Center.
Okay. And did you have the opportunity to see your mother's reaction to all of this?
Yes, she was terrified for him. And the very first weekend, I talked her into going home because I think she needed some rest. And so I talked her into going home and that Andy and I would stay. And Wes spiked a fever and a bad infection, and she never left after that.
After returning home, Wesley lived on and off at his parents' house. During one of those times where he was living elsewhere, he decided to stop by and see his mom. When he arrived at the home, his mother was there, unconscious, with pills spilled everywhere. The beginning of a suicide note she had started was next to her, but none of her children ever got the chance to read that note because the authorities took it. Wesley ran to the neighbors for help. They called 911 and Vicky was rushed to the hospital. It was the aftermath of this suicide attempt that the defense concentrated on during the trial. According to her children, Vicky was mad she had been found.
After the 2003 attempted suicide, she went to the hospital.
Yes.
Did you go to the hospital to see her?
Yes.
When you saw her in the hospital, did you ask her why she did this?
Yes.
And what was your understanding?
She just said she didn't want to be here anymore.
Okay. And did she ever make a statement when she was either at the hospital or leaving the hospital about if she did it again, you wouldn't find her?
Yes.
Did she tell that to you?
Yes.
At the time after your mom had attempted suicide, did you have a conversation with your mom about the fact that she had made that attempt on her life?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And at that time, was there a statement made that was somewhat disturbing to you?
Yes.
Okay.
She had
The person she said that to. What did she say?
She had stated that no one would find her next time.
At any point, did she ever, at some point after that incident, talk to you about the fact she didn't mean that statement?
Yes, she did.
Okay. So what was the context of that? When did that happen?
When I had confronted her. Well, I didn't confront her. When I had talked to her about a coworker of mine being in the hospital for attempting suicide, and then she had gotten home and she had succeeded. And I had called mom and I was And I remember specifically I was standing in Target and I had said, "Mom, look, it's so bad that you feel this is your only way out." And she said, it's a feeling that no one can ever know unless they've been there. It's something you can't describe. And she said, and you feel that's your only option. And then she did tell me, she goes, "I say that, but I really don't mean it."
Vicky continued to seek treatment and the family moved on. Wesley eventually moved back in with his mom and stepfather. It would be roughly 6 years later that Vicky would again scare her family. But this time, it was an accidental overdose. She was clear it wasn't intentional, and Jim and the children believed her.
Now, in that incident, did your mom leave a note that time?
No.
Okay. And did you have discussions with her about that incident?
Yes.
She herself told you that that was just accidental, that she had taken too many pills?
Yes.
Okay. And your stepfather, Jim, that was also how he perceived it?
Yes.
The family again seemed to be back on track, but Vicky worried that Jim wasn't being faithful. It was a suspicion that had plagued her for years.
Through the years, were you aware that there were concerns by your mom about infidelity with your dad?
Yes.
And specifically, had you received information that he may have had some extramarital affairs?
Yes.
Was there ever a time that he was even in your room talking to somebody?
Yes.
When was that? What was that about?
That was when we lived on Comanche, and okay. We had come home, and he was talking in a flirtatious voice in our bedroom. And when we told my mom about it, he told my mom we were lying. And so my mom bought a caller ID and hid it, knowing that we weren't lying.
But Jim and Vicky continued with their marriage. In 2012, Vicky was diagnosed with colon cancer. She had surgery to put a colostomy bag in place, and her mobility was very limited. She had to use a walker or a cane at times. In November of 2012, Vicky's daughter Marcia had made arrangements to pick up Dish television equipment from her mom. They were canceling the service and had to have it sent back by a certain time. Jim called before she arrived, asking if she could come another time because Vicky wasn't feeling well. Marcia thought it was odd because Jim never called her. She explained this was the only day she could come because of when the equipment was due back. Marcia arrived at the house. Her mother seemed out of it.
So I start looking for the equipment to send back, and Jim is very frazzled and doesn't seem to know where anything is. And I had asked about my mom, and he said she wasn't feeling well. I didn't go into the room right away. I was looking for the remotes, and I knew that one of them probably was in the room. So I went in the room, and my mom was laying at the end of the bed, like if she was sitting down at the end of the bed and then fell back. And she was just wearing her underwear and a white T-shirt. There was some blood, dried blood on the T-shirt, which didn't strike me as anything wrong right away because she gets bloody noses. But what did concern me is that she wasn't awake and she didn't even appear to be normally sleeping, and that he went over to her and he said, "Hun," and he picked up her arms to lift her to sitting, and she just flopped back on the bed. And I knew there was something wrong because she didn't even respond. She didn't open her eyes. She didn't roll her eyes. She did nothing. And I'm like, "We need to take her to the hospital. We need to call the ambulance." And he said, no, we can't call the ambulance. And I'm like, why? I'm like, put her in my truck. I can get her to the hospital faster
than taking an ambulance. And he said, no, this is what happened when she was in the hospital, when she had a reaction to her medicine. I'm sure that's what this is.
Jim wrote it off as a bad reaction to the medication. Marcia said she took him at his word at the time. But now she feels differently.
In hindsight, Marcia, do you wish you would have called somebody?
Yes. Okay.
Do you feel you walked in on something at that time?
I do.
In early 2013, Vicky had the colostomy bag removed. She still needed the cane but could walk small amounts without it. On the morning of April 25th, 2013, the day started normally, like most days. Jim left for work around 5 in the morning. Vicky got up and yelled for Wesley to come downstairs and get coffee. It was a morning ritual for the two. Jim came home around 1 p.m. to take Vicky to an appointment with a psychiatrist. Wesley remembered his mom being in good spirits, and she was even wearing makeup. After the appointment, Jim went to the grocery store and picked up chicken. The three sat down for dinner, and Wesley asked his mom about the appointment. In his testimony in court, he said Vicky told him it went well. During his original statement to law enforcement, he said Vicky said it went so-so. But according to an interview Jim had later with a private investigator, the appointment had not gone well. Here's what he said.
I went in with her. You did go in. And she wasn't happy with that psychiatrist.
Did she have a lot of conversation with the psychiatrist that day?
Not a lot,
But she talked.
That I remember. You know, she talked, but not a lot. Talking about more about the medication than...
In regards to medication, when she took her medication, did you dispense it to her?
I would give it to her in the morning before I'd leave. And I had a thing where I'd put what she's supposed to take, like at noon. And then at night, you know, and some of them, you know, like the sleeping pills, sometimes she didn't want the sleeping pill. I don't need it tonight. Well, I, you know, didn't force it on her.
What was the conversation like on the way home from the psychiatrist?
She didn't really say a whole lot. It just didn't talk. You know, didn't seem to talk. I said, well, what do you think? I just don't like her. I don't like talking to her. I feel uncomfortable. You know, she was more upset with the psychiatrist than anything.
But one part of the dinner didn't change in Wesley's memory. A confrontation between Jim and Vicky.
I remember... confrontation about Jim not wanting to go to the dollar store for, I believe it was a tablecloth.
Let me stop you there. So you're saying a confrontation. Who is that between?
My mom and Jim.
Okay. And so that's something that's happening as you're sitting at that table on that Thursday evening?
Yes.
The defense pointed out that Wesley had a truck at the time and could have offered to take his mom to pick out a tablecloth at the dollar store himself. Wesley said he didn't have the gas to do so. But the defense also pointed out that he had enough gas to go to a friend's house that evening.
When you were asked by the defense about driving her to doctor appointments, you said you never had. It was Jim that would drive her. Is that right?
Yes.
Because around this time in the last year, 2 years of your mom's life, when she didn't have a car, your mom wasn't driving herself places, was she?
No.
She was relying on others to take her somewhere, correct?
Yes.
And when the defense asked you if you also ever took her on errands, you indicated you rarely did that. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Had you been present at other times when your mom would ask your dad to do something or take her somewhere where he wouldn't do that?
Yes.
So the access that your mom had at that time leaving the house was coming from your father, Jim. Is that right?
Yes.
Because she doesn't have an internet, so you never saw her communicating with anybody in that way, the way some people do with media, correct?
Correct.
And with respect to not having a smartphone, she wasn't texting somebody for things like that. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the red phone that you just identified that was then taken into custody by police, that was the phone that your mom was using at the time, right?
Yes.
With regard to, now you were asked a lot of questions the last several years of her life. Let's talk about the last few months of her life from January to April, when she goes missing after she's had health problems. Is she walking down the street in Pittsfield?
No.
Is she going down that trail near that house?
No.
At this time, was your mom in general with her health not feeling the best?
No, she was not.
In the statement Wesley gave to the police, he said he saw his mother in the kitchen and he told her he was going over to his friend's house. She told him okay and he left. He said he was there all night until he came home around 4 a.m. As he drove down their street, he said he saw another truck. He didn't recognize it at first and continued home. The truck also pulled into their driveway, and it was then he realized it was Jim's work truck.
So as you're pulling in, do you see who gets out of the vehicle?
Yes.
Who is that?
Jim.
And does it appear, from what you can see, anybody's in the vehicle with Jim?
No.
You can't see?
There's nobody in the vehicle with him.
Okay. And as you get out of your vehicle, what happens?
He was walking up to the house, and when I pulled in, he turned around and started walking towards me as I was getting out of the truck, and the first thing he said to me was, "Mom's gone."
Okay. And at that time, what was your reaction to that?
What do you mean, Mom's gone?
Okay. What did he say?
I woke up and she's not here.
And then what happened?
He said he's been out looking for her and that he's going to go out and continue looking for her.
Wesley didn't understand what Jim was saying at first. He asked if they should call the authorities. Jim said he would and said he was going to go back out and search for a bit. Wesley, due to his physical state after the burns, could walk, but it wasn't an easy task for him, mentally or physically. So he decided to stay home and wait for his mother. But she would never show up. The next morning, Jim went to work at McKeefries & Sons, an excavating contractor. He mentioned to no one at work that Vicky was missing, and he still hadn't called the police. Wesley assumed his stepfather was calling the authorities and other family members. After work, Jim came home. Vicky still wasn't home. That's when Jim called the authorities. It was the only call he made. Officer Christine Bilgo responded and searched the home. During the search, Vicky's purse was located. It contained all of her identification and her cigarettes, the one item all of her children said she wouldn't leave home without. Also left behind was her flip cell phone and her cane. Vicky had been taking walks without it to gain strength, but if she was going to leave the house for a longer walk, she would take it. Officer Bilgo looked at Vicky's phone. Most of the calls were from or to Jim, but there was another number she had called in the last week, her daughter Stacy. Officer Bilgo decided to call her. It was the first time Stacy had heard her mother was missing. Jim hadn't called any of them to tell them Vicky was gone.
When you received that telephone call, what were you told?
I was told my mom was missing.
And was that something that, what was your thoughts at the time when you heard that?
I didn't have any thoughts. I was shocked. I didn't expect to hear that.
And you hadn't heard that from anyone else?
No.
Nobody called you to see if you had been with her or picked her up or spent time with her or anything?
Nobody.
Stacy called her older sister, Marcia. Marcia then called Jim.
And do you remember what he said to you?
She's gone.
And those are the words he used, she is gone?
I said, what do you mean she's gone? He said, she's finally done it.
And that's what Jim was impressing upon you had happened?
Yes.
He's finally...
finally done it.
Finally done it.
Jim originally told Stacy he thought their mom went for a walk and that he tried to look for her when he woke up at 3 a.m.
Did you ask him what happened, what he knew about it?
Yes.
What did he say?
He just said he got up when he said he had gotten up at 3 a.m. like he does all the time. And mom wasn't in bed, which is not unusual. She's a night owl. And he said he looked all over for her, all over in the house. He went outside to see if she was out there. And then he got in his truck and went and looked. Drove up and down the road and looked and said she wasn't nowhere around.
And as a result...
he thinks she went for a walk. Because she's trying to get stronger.
So he thought she just had walked away?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, your mom did like to take walks. Is that right?
Yes.
But had you ever known her to be walking down a road in the middle of the night?
No.
When you're talking about taking walks, would that have been something more general during the daylight hours?
Correct.
Would that have been more around her yard?
Yes.
So with respect to thinking she would have just walked in the middle of the night, did that seem unusual?
She wouldn't walk in the middle of the night.
She wouldn't have walked off that property?
There's no streetlights. It's the country.
The thoughts of where their mom could be consumed her children.
Well, I started asking him where I thought she would be, and he didn't know. And so I started thinking about where I thought she would go. So before going to the house, I stopped at the cemetery because we have an older sister that died at birth before me. And my mom would go to the cemetery, and you would know anytime she'd been there because she'd meticulously groom the grave, picking all the strands of grass around it. And so if my mom was going to do something to hurt herself, she would have reached out to one of us, which she hadn't, and otherwise gone there. How she would have gotten there, I have no idea. But that was what I was thinking.
Okay.
And there was no sign that anyone had been there.
The grave hadn't been touched. Marcia racked her brain for other places her mom might go. Then she finally made it to the house. Jim told her the police were supposed to be searching with really good dogs. The next morning, when Marcia arrived around 7 a.m., Jim cracked a beer open and sat in his recliner, while police and volunteers continued searching for Vicky. It was that morning when Jim first made a statement that left people wondering if Vicky had really wandered off, done something to herself, or if it was something else.
On that day, did you have the opportunity to hear anything else Jim may have said that was concerning to you about your mother being missing?
Yeah, he was sitting in the kitchen at the table, and he's like, I don't know what we're going to do with all of her shit. Look at all this stuff. This place is too big for two people. And then he said, I know she didn't want an obituary. And he said, we're gonna have to call up U-Haul, a U-Haul or something like that to take all this stuff to Goodwill.
And how did you feel about a comment like that from him?
Well, we didn't know where my mom was, so that was confusing. And the only thing I knew is in the pit of my stomach is I thought, something's not right.
Because you're still hoping your mom's going to walk through that door.
Right, we still haven't found her, so why are we talking about getting rid of her things?
The community and law enforcement continued searching. The canines found no sign of Vicky. Marcia and her sister began reaching out to the media, using social media, and creating a missing person flyer. But Jim never went on an official search, and some people recalled him making odd comments. It was those comments that began to raise suspicions. For example, he reportedly told searchers they weren't going to find her and that they were wasting their time.
You will never find her. She's not there. You're wasting your time searching that area. The defendant's own daughter, who you'll hear from, Lisa Masti, told officers that the defendant would express anger, that more searches were being done to try to locate his missing wife. Again, at this point, it's a missing persons investigation.
By September 2013, 5 months since Vicky's disappearance, Jim had removed her from his insurance, and he had also found a new lady friend.
Having a lady friend, what is that about? Do you remember where you first learned about that?
Yeah, we were sitting at that table, and he said that he had met this lady friend, and that wasn't like he just met her, but that he'd known her for years, and that we would really like her, that she had two kids our age, and that had he known that she got divorced, he'd have never married my mom.
Marcia and her siblings were shocked to hear some of his comments about his lady friend, Kathy Friday. According to Vicky's children, he never seemed worried about Vicky's whereabouts. Meanwhile, Jim and Kathy continued to spend time together. But the story of how they met changed. He initially told Vicky's children that he knew Kathy before marrying Vicky, and that he would call or contact her on her birthday. But then later, he said they had reconnected after 20 years during a chance encounter at a casino, weeks after Vicky disappeared. The more Jim didn't seem bothered by Vicky's disappearance, the more the authorities continued to look into him. Part of that line of investigation included officers meeting with and interviewing him. The lead investigator, Brown County Sergeant Roman Aronstein, was at the home the day Vicky was reported missing. He and his partner recorded their first interview with Jim on April 26th. The interview was roughly 47 minutes long. Part of that discussion was about Vicky's medications. Based on Vicky's medical history, it was important that all her medications were accounted for. Jim mentioned he couldn't find one of her medicines. It left a hired private investigator, Larry Warwick, to question the method in which Vicky received her medications. Here's Jim talking to Larry about that.
So she had access to her medication anytime she wanted to take it.
I had it in a box, locked.
No, that's what I asked you.
Yeah, well, locked. But she knew where the key was.
Okay.
And like her medication, the doctor had told her, you know, she said, some days I don't want to take that Xanax 3 or 4 times a day. She said, I don't need it. He said, that's fine. If you feel you need one or you need it, take one.
Jim told investigators he hoped Vicky didn't take her life, and he told them about her past attempts. Part of his peculiar behavior wasn't just in his desire to move on. He made statements about a quarry 3 miles from his house. Investigators dredged the quarry, but there was no sign of Vicky.
They did search those quarries. You might go back there and think, I don't know, they searched the quarries 3 times. What's important with that? That they kept getting tips regarding that, so they looked and they looked. And they searched and they researched. The facts are that they looked at any possibility to find Victoria. And it's not just about finding her so they could determine whether or not there was a criminal case. They're trying to find her. They're trying to find a mom for a family.
When law enforcement spoke with Jim's coworkers, there was another location that caught their interest. Co-worker Michael Blazer, who knew Jim by the name of Curly, told them that Jim hadn't mentioned Vicky was missing. He also told them about the sludge ponds, which are normally used to dispose of industrial waste. The material is often unstable, making the ponds very hard to search.
With respect to the stability of these cells or these ponds, so the jury would understand with respect to a sludge pond, that is a more vast area that things are dumped into, waste is dumped into. Is that right?
Yes.
And with respect to the sludge going in there, if something would go in there, is that something that could no longer be seen at some point?
Depends how heavy it is, if it sinks or not.
Years went by. Brown County sheriffs interviewed Jim again in 2018. This time, he made conflicting statements and grew angry at investigators' questions.
Yeah, I know you don't. But say, I can get something after your wife. You'd be able to tell her what she had on or what she wore. If you guys didn't get something, damn it, the rest of you all be in. Because I did. Okay. I'm not going to tell you what I did. And if you guys didn't get something, he said I did at that interview, right to me. I know you did something to that woman.
Because sometimes you get angry like this, and I don't feel safe. So I asked him.
I don't get angry very often, but this is getting to be.
What's ridiculous? I just ask you to.
We're trying to help you.
I know.
Try to help you remember.
But 3.5 years ago.
I don't remember.
At one point, he said something shocking. He said, "I killed her." It was a statement he quickly recanted. The investigation into Jim continued. Authorities searched his residence, removing computers and files. They also held a John Doe hearing. A John Doe hearing allows law enforcement to question witnesses and suspects under oath, to offer immunity from prosecution, and to compel the testimony of any reluctant witnesses. They held the hearing on May 8, 2019. At the hearing, Jim was asked a multitude of questions. One of them was about his search for Vicky before Wesley arrived home around 4 a.m. He had told authorities the route he took. But when they looked on surveillance cameras at gas stations, there was no sign of Jim's work truck. Also in that hearing, Jim's timeline continued to change. He originally said he went to bed around 10 p.m., but law enforcement noted his bed was made and didn't appear to have been slept in. During the John Doe hearing, he said he slept in the recliner in his living room. He had also told authorities about how he had called Vicky multiple times after he realized she was missing. Her phone showed no record of these multiple calls, nor did the phone records. There was only one, right at 4 a.m. During the hearing, Jim also said something peculiar. He said, "If I could shit my wife's body out in order to protect Kathy, I would." Jim's girlfriend, Kathy Friday, also testified about how she and Jim had met and when they started dating. She backed his story up, that they had run into each other at a casino weeks after Vicky disappeared. After the hearing, investigators interviewed Jim again. This time, he admitted to lying and said he had been lying for years. He said he had lied in order to protect his relationship with Kathy. Quote, "I did not kill my wife, Vicky, but I did lie to the police for years in connection with the investigation surrounding her disappearance. Ultimately, I lied in court today as well while I was under oath. I understand that lying to the police and to the court was the wrong and illegal thing to do, but I did not kill my wife. I lied because Kathy and I were trying to keep our stories straight." Jim said he and Kathy had lied about meeting weeks after Vicky's disappearance because they didn't want to look bad to their families. Jim also claimed when he told Sergeant Aronstein that he had killed her, that was only due to his desperation, that he did not kill her. Once Jim admitted to lying, he and Kathy Friday were both arrested. They were charged with perjury and conspiracy to commit perjury. But that wasn't all. Investigators believed Jim had murdered Vicky. Shortly after the arrest, Jim's charges began to pile up. He was charged with first-degree intentional homicide with a domestic abuse modifier and resisting and obstructing an officer. At his trial, the prosecution called Vicky's psychiatrist, Dr. Ashraf Ahmed, to talk about her relationship with Jim. According to his testimony, in February 2009, Vicky began to talk about Jim being controlling and abusing her, a point prosecutors made during opening statements. Vicky had no car, Jim regulated her medication, and he was really the only person she spoke with. In fact, Dr. Ahmed said her relationship and abuse was really the only thing she was struggling with at the time.
Reporting that she has been really struggling was a lot of resentment and anger, period. Her prescriptions do not get filled. She feels that she is forgetful and she doesn't take her medication as prescribed. Her husband is still very critical to her illness. She has not seen primary care physician for quite some time, and she feels angry about that. Victoria feels very frustrated and experiences a lot of resentment. You feel most of her frustration comes from dealing with her illness and dealing with taking numerous medication and the feeling that her husband is controlling.
The defense focused their questions to Dr. Ahmed about Vicky's mental health, returning back to her multiple personality disorder diagnosis.
There was concerns about her being paranoid and suspicious of hearing voices, correct?
Yes.
Did that raise any concerns in your mind about her multiple personalities coming back?
No, really. You see, the term multiple personality is an old and almost invalid diagnosis. It was used elaborately during an era of psychoanalysis where people assume, nowadays this term is kind of fading away and like rarely used. We don't use the term multiple personality. Most psychiatrists frown on it because it's a term that really, that's not the case in her case. Multiple personality is an old diagnosis. And the doctor who actually diagnosed her with that was maybe 20, 30 years ago when that diagnosis was quite valid. Nowadays, you cannot see it in any psychiatrist's note. It's very unusual.
Can some people hear different voices in their head that they think it's a different personality?
What happened is that some people have tendency to develop psychotic features under stress, like when you're super anxious. Some people are vulnerable, like and the foundation of psychosis usually is anxiety, like somebody so anxious that you start hearing things. But it doesn't transform into our field into psychosis until this person has a lasting delusions or hallucination that start to affect their behavior, that the person lack insight. So when somebody comes to me and tell me I hear voices, yeah, that's a psychosis. But that's not psychosis, because usually the people who are psychotic will say, Michael is talking to me. He believed that this is real. But when somebody comes to me and said, I hear voices, that means he has insight that these things are not real. He's negotiating them. And that was, in her case, it was a state where she was just so anxious, so isolated, and it's easy for her to feel these voices. It fills a void.
Dr. Ahmed told the court Jim was critical of Vicky's mental illness, which is where most of her frustration stemmed from. He last saw Vicky 9 months before she disappeared. He said things were going well for her, and he didn't believe she was suicidal. After Jim was placed in the Brown County Jail, he continued to talk, this time to inmates. At his trial, witness number one was brought in secretly into court to protect their identity. The witness told the jury that Jim said he was, quote, 100% sure his wife was dead and her body wouldn't be found. Jim had also tried to use this witness to break a condition ordered by the court after his perjury charge. Jim and Kathy were supposed to have no contact with each other. He asked this witness to reach out to her. While the public wasn't able to hear this witness or another jailhouse informant, the district attorney did discuss their testimony during a motion to dismiss the case. This is what prosecutor Wendy Lemkuhl said.
The statements of this defendant that he made to not only the searchers from the beginning, that she's gone, you're wasting your time, she's not coming back, Marcia testifying she's dead, to witness one and witness two, who he indicated to separate times separately that he's 100% certain she's dead. You're not 100% certain unless you were involved in that, and that she was not coming back, and that law enforcement would not find her. And even if they did, there would be no blood, there would be no teeth, there would be no way of identifying her. I think the circumstantial evidence in this case is overwhelming with respect to that. Throw in his prior history of assault of conduct to a previous wife and eerily telling her, you're not going to get out of here alive, and witness two saying that Jim Prokopovich said to him that there was a dispute where till death do us part, depart, and that he indicated that she would not leave him if she weren't in a garbage bag. Hearing all of that information on a no-body homicide, the intent comes from the fact that there is no other explanation. If you are getting rid of somebody and you are getting rid of their body, that is intentional. At this juncture, based upon the motion before the court, the status under the law is that the court is to see the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. I think with the circumstantial evidence in this case, which led to some direct evidence in other areas, that it overwhelmingly shows that Mr. Prokopovich could be believed to be responsible for count one. We are asking the court to deny the motion.
The motion to dismiss was ultimately denied. The defense asked witness number one if Jim had given details on how he killed his wife. The answer was no. The defense said it was merely James assuming Vicky was dead after 6 years of no sign of her.
They say my client was the only one that saw her before she disappeared. It's not exactly true. You're going to find out that James and Victoria lived with Victoria's son, Wesley. Wesley was there the day she disappeared. Wesley doesn't know what happened to her. Jim doesn't know what happened to her. The only person to know what's happened to Victoria is Victoria.
Witness number one wasn't the only person Jim had asked to contact Kathy after their arrests. He gave instructions to his sister about his finances to relay to her. He also told her to tell Kathy that he loved her bunches. Police and prosecutors continued to prepare for the trial, but when the time came, Kathy was unable to testify against her boyfriend. In November of 2020, Kathy Friday died by suicide. Her daughter, however, testified about her mother's behavior and a secret cell phone.
I found where they had their first phone conversation, I think May 19th, and several phone conversations after that. I mean, all hours of the day, night. And so I also found that she was going to, you know, in talking with my brother, that she was going to Wittenberg every weekend to the casino to be with him. So I kind of got all of that background information that, you know, I could find out from my brother and whatnot. And then when we went to Georgia the second time in September, she showed up to pick me up to drive down to Milwaukee again. And at some point she pulled out a new phone. And I said, oh, you got a new phone? And she said, yes. Which was odd because later in the trip, all of a sudden she pulled out her old phone. And I wasn't sure what that was about. And I asked her and she said she used her old phone for setting alarms.
So now you're seeing your mom has two phones.
Correct.
Okay.
But after she picked me up to go to Milwaukee on her, we were maybe within an hour of home, and she got a phone call. And it was the same kind of conversation, the whole okie-dokie. It was just weird. And so when she hung up, that's when I confronted her. I said, are you dating someone? I get the feeling like you don't want me to know, but I'm not understanding what's going on. And that's when she laid it all out, that yes, she was dating. She told me the name. I kind of played dumb like I didn't know anything. And she told me that his wife went missing. And I said I, you know, said that I was shocked and was trying to get information from her. I asked her if she was concerned that his wife was missing, and she said that his wife has attempted suicide multiple times in the past, and that's what's believed to have happened. And I said, then, you know, where is she then? And she said, well, there are quarries around the area. There's lots of vegetation, and hopefully a hunter will find her. And the way she said it, I was so taken aback by her coldness. To this day, I can still picture her, how it was just like no emotion, no, just like, yeah, this is what happened. And
by the end of the trial, the prosecution had called 44 witnesses over the course of 7 days. They then rested. The defense called none. In their closing arguments, the prosecution laid out their case once more.
2,864 days. That's how many days have gone by since Victoria Prokopovitz went missing. She never made Marcia and Andy's 25th anniversary celebration. She missed seeing her son Wes get married to Bree in the last year. She never got to see her daughter, Stacy, become a grandmother to her 2-year-old grandson. Now, on that day, April 25th of 2020, between April 25th and April 26th of 2013, that long time ago, this family has grieved for the loss of this woman. They have searched for their mother. They've lost time with her. They've lost holidays with her. They've regularly kept in touch with law enforcement, offering any information that they had. And I'm talking about Stacy, Marcia, and Wes.
She said while they were all grieving and looking for answers, another member of that family moved on with their life, benefited from Vicky being missing, and didn't reach out to law enforcement. That was Jim.
The defendant, from the beginning, said she is gone. She is dead. You are wasting your time. And ultimately, to a couple of lay citizens who didn't know Vicky, and they didn't know Jim before they happened to be housed with him at the Brown County Jail, that he indicated to them that he was 100% certain that Vicky is dead. And furthermore, that they're never going to find her body.
She said sometimes law enforcement have to look hard at what occurred, and sometimes it takes years for them to figure it out. But sometimes, she said, what happened and who did it is right before their eyes.
They evaluate who had reasons, who had the knowledge, who was with Victoria the night she disappeared, who had the opportunity, the last person to see her, who would benefit when she was gone, who would save money from not having to pay for her medical insurance, her dental insurance, who would save money because there wasn't a WPS bill, as you heard. Gone. I hope you picked up on that in this case. Gone. It's the word that from the beginning, when Wes pulled into that driveway, sees his dad pulling in, thinking it's kind of weird, that when he meets up, gets out of his car, the first thing Jim says to him, Mama's gone. That word is pivotal in this case.
In the defense's closing arguments, they circled back again to a statement Vicky made 10 years earlier.
Next time, nobody will find me. Those are the words of Victoria Prokopovitz. Those are the words that ring true in this case. Next time, you won't find me. You've sat through hours of testimony. You've listened to the state basically direct their witnesses to their answers. But no words ring more true than next time you won't find me.
They concentrated on the lack of physical evidence in the home and claimed the prosecution focused solely on emotion.
The state is trying to convince you through emotion that my client is guilty. This is not a court of emotion. This is a court of law. The state wants you to start with a conclusion. Victoria Prokopovich is missing. She's dead. And that Jim Prokopovich killed her. That's the conclusion. They didn't give you a beginning. They didn't give you a middle. They just gave you an ending. And they're trying to gaslight you into emotion to find a verdict.
He said the state has not proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
The state wants you to believe that my client killed his wife sometime after Wesley left and before he got home. So let's break that down a little bit. Did they tell you how it happened? No. They gave you theories. They said, well, he could have strangled her. Could have. Doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt. How could he have strangled her? If somebody is getting strangled and they wanted to live, wouldn't there have been some sort of struggle, some sort of signs of a disturbance, marks on Jim that she was thrashing back? And that he did it before Wesley came home? Not knowing when he was going to come home? And he did it so perfectly. You've heard them say, well, Jim's a drunk. He was drinking. He was intoxicated. That's when he gets angry. So an intoxicated person strangled his wife, concealed it so perfectly, drove her, and they threw out quarries, sludge ponds, sand pits. And he did it so perfectly that his son didn't notice anything odd about him when he came home. They're really throwing a lot of stakes at that, aren't they?
He told the jury to judge the facts and apply the law.
You may ask yourself, why didn't he call any witnesses? Because the state's witnesses were my witnesses. There was nobody else around but Jim, Wesley, and Vicky. Jim doesn't have to prove his innocence. He starts being innocent.
The jury deliberated for about 2 full days before reaching their verdict.
As to the offense of first-degree intentional homicide, as charged in count 1 of the Second Amended information, we, the jury, find the defendant, James M. Prokopovich. The verdict has been marked guilty.
Guilty on all counts. 75-year-old James Prokopovich is currently awaiting his sentence, although he will likely spend the rest of his life in prison. Victoria Vicky Prokopovich is still missing. She was last seen wearing a white jacket, a black and white shirt with gray stretch pants, and black shoes with a stacked heel. On April 25th, 2013, she was 5'3" and 117 pounds. She has brown hair and brown eyes. There's a rose tattoo on her and a skunk on the back of her hip. If you know where Vicky is, you should contact the Brown County Sheriff's Office. Since Vicky's disappearance, her daughter Marsha has become very active in the missing persons community. She helped found Wisconsin Missing Person Advocacy to help other families of missing persons. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Do you agree with the verdict? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Polly Katowski with Law and Crime. You can follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Polly Katowski. And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.